And please welcome our panelists, President and CEO, Water Health International, Trollence Addy. Former Prime Minister, Portuguese Republic, High Commissioner, United Nations Human Rights Commission, Antonio Guterres.
Minister of State and Environment, Uganda, Maria Mutagamba.
And Chairperson, Argyam Trust, Rohini Nilikani.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you very much for coming into this session on water, sanitation, and hygiene. I'm pleased that you're in here, but first of all, I want you to imagine that you're somewhere else. Specifically, you're in your hotel room in Delhi. It's 4:30 in the morning. The alarm clock has just rung to wake you up, and you've realized you are going on the trip of a lifetime because you're going to see the Taj Mahal. It's the world's most famous and most beautiful building. The first thing you do is you use the toilet in your hotel room. You have a quick shower. You jump in the cab. You get on the train. As you relax in the train to Agra, what are you going to see as you look out of the window? The answer is you're going to see a row of thousands and thousands of other people's bottoms, because those people do not have toilets. And the only place they can go is along the side of the railway track. Now imagine the indignity and the revulsion that those people feel day after day. That's why President Clinton gave a really stirring comment about the commitments on water and sanitation yesterday, and that's why you're sitting in this room with us today. So thanks for that. Out of 6 billion people in the world, 1 billion don't have drinking water. 2.5 billion don't have even basic sanitation. Lack of sanitation and hygiene is the second biggest killer of children in the world. Half the hospital beds in Africa are occupied by people with diarrhea. Okay, but there is a positive side to all of that. Because if we can improve water, sanitation and hygiene, we can relieve a tenth of the global burden of disease. We can generate an economic return in the order of $6 or $8 for every dollar that we invest in water and sanitation. We can improve people's education, the status and dignity, especially that of women, and we can contribute to improving the environment. So there are lots of positive sides, and we're going to come back to those during our discussions. I just want to throw out a couple of the major issues that we'll be touching on and that I'm sure our panelists will mention. If we look particularly at water, we've got to cope with the huge problems of urbanization. We've got to cope with the increasing scarcity and difficulty of actually finding the source of good quality drinking water. We need to absorb new ideas and new sorts of organizations to work in the water sector. Looking at sanitation, we need an enormous push on sanitation. I mean, those headline numbers tell you that already. And in particular, we need to change our mindsets in sanitation from a charitable approach as a minor charitable sector to a major and regular economic part of everyday human life. And that's the particular aspect that my organization has put in with our commitment for launching a global sanitation fund. That's a $30 million commitment we're looking for support from the CGI members for. In terms of hygiene, hygiene is completely different because it's not about things, it's not about objects. It's about people and their behavior. And so we have to really understand how to communicate with people about changing their behavior. And overall, there's a theme running through that, which is about putting the people themselves at the center of our thinking and tailoring the solutions and the work that all of us collectively are putting into it to the needs and the wishes and the requirements of the people rather than forcing it vice versa. So it's a simple problem, but it has complex solutions. We're not going to solve any of that alone. We need a wide variety of people. And we've got a great bunch of people on the panel You've heard the introductions of them. And the way I'm going to do it is I'll first of all ask everybody, each panelist, one question. Then we may go through a second round. But in the meantime, if you want to ask questions, each table has somebody with the computer. If you pass your question to them, that will get fed magically through to me, and I can then bring those in to the questions to the panel as well. And I'll be encouraging our panelists also to sort of build on each other's on each other's points, so that I hope we can have a, you know, an enjoyable and interesting session. Rohini, let me start with you. Can you tell me a bit about how you see the role of philanthropists and of foundations fitting into this broad picture that I was just describing?
Thank you, John. I think at the CGI, I don't need to tell people about the role of philanthropy. They've all done philanthropy 101 when they entered this place. But I will say that it's very heartening to see the expansion of philanthropy happening globally. At the same time, I will take this opportunity to place a bit of caution. I see philanthropy swinging in a bit in the pendulum from being just open-ended charity to being very measurable kind of philanthropy. And while that is very good, we should not swing too far on that as well. So I will say to this entire audience that philanthropy is a lot finally about values and about heart. And I think what we do need in philanthropy today is much more of it, but much more of it with a lot of patience and a great deal of humility. Having said that, I think in the water and sanitation sector, there are many, many things that good minds and deep pockets can put into this. There's a lot to be done in terms of access to basic, safe drinking water just for livelihoods and obviously for life. And sanitation, you've just posed the whole challenges. We need good design. We need a lot of toilets to be built. We need to rethink how sanitation can be sustainable. We need to look at social processes that are embedded in our political processes that allow people to think for themselves about water and sanitation so they can move to the next stages of their lives.
Thanks very much. Trelance, can I come across to you? You're an entrepreneur, you know, you're a businessman, you're a private sector guy. Tell us how you see the role of entrepreneurs fitting into this picture on water and sanitation.
I think the important point for entrepreneurs is to extend what philanthropists do, targeted at sustainability primarily. I think when we look at the water and sanitation field, we would recognize that over the last 50 years, there's been a lot of philanthropic activity. I think the disappointment of a lot of the people who've done it is that after they remove the active intervention, things begin to deteriorate. I think when you study it, it's for very clear reasons that that's the way it's going to be. The people who we classify as underserved are not in high-density areas where big infrastructure programs will work, and therefore you've seen this gap. Entrepreneurs, by intense focus on those aspects of the program or of the problem that can solve the problem, perhaps on a commercial level, leveraging the money and efforts of philanthropists and NGOs, could actually bring sustainable solutions with the burden not on the community to do all these things, but on the entrepreneur to make sure that what they do is sustainable. And that's really what we're trying to get to.
Oh, thank you very much. Maria, you've been very prominent in political leadership in Africa on water and sanitation. Tell us the secret. You know, what are the political processes that really work, that can achieve progress in water and sanitation?
Thank you very much. It's not really a secret. It is an open secret. Governments have got a responsibility to provide the basic needs, that is water. Water is life. And as such, for quite some time, we have actually championed the cause for water. But it's only recently, actually, at the World Summit for Sustainable Development in Johannesburg, that the issue of sanitation came on board. And I'm happy to report that most of the African governments have picked that one up. They are implementing both water and sanitation targets. We have undertaken reforms in water and sanitation. And even this year, water and sanitation came at the highest level of the political agenda when heads of state met at the 11th session, ordinary session in Sharm el-Sheikh in Cairo to talk about water and sanitation. So I think it has got that attention. again, government has gone further, as you heard my friend say, to engage, because government alone cannot do all the work. We are engaging the private sector. So we are encouraging private-public partnerships, and I think that those are doing a lot of work for us. And we are also engaging the civil society, enabling them, you know, giving them support so that they can reach the grassroots. But at the policy of government, if I may talk about government in my country, we have actually gone into identifying those things that cannot be done by the ordinary person or things that could be done that are ignored. For instance, in this year's ministerial policy statement, I'm emphasizing rainwater harvesting as an issue. It has not been around. We have taken it for granted. But this time, government is coming out to emphasize rainwater harvesting at household level, community level, and then at national level, where it is absolutely necessary to have strategic reserves. Because we all know, on the continent of Africa, water security is something new. And governments should come out to encourage water security by putting strategic reserves for purposes of hedging against prolonged droughts, especially now during the times of climate change.
Thank you very much. Antonio, you have a responsibility for looking after the refugees and displaced people of the world. That's something we admire hugely. Looking at water and sanitation, you know, what are the sort of special aspects of water and sanitation for refugees that are different from other sorts of water and sanitation work?
Well, first of all, it's very difficult to meet the standards. Refugee emergencies occur in many remote areas, sometimes in very dry areas. And to give you an example, only in 50% of our refugee camps we are able to meet the 20 liters per person per day that we should be doing. And it's not only a question of quantity, it's a question of distance to the water points, it's a question of the quality of the sanitation system. It's a question of how to do it. Again, quality in general, sustainability, reliability, equity. So huge difficulty in meeting the standards. Second point, second difficulty, how to make sure that the community has ownership. It's much more difficult for a refugee community than for a local community that lives in their own country. Then the conflict between the refugee community and the local community in many circumstances when water is a scarce resource. And how to make this problem become an opportunity of dialogue between the two communities. And finally, I would say the extreme difficulty in providing to the refugees when they go back home, and refugees want to go back home. Last year, we helped 750,000 people go back home around the world, and it's the preferred solution for refugees. When they go back home in southern Sudan or in DRC or in many other countries, what is there to receive them? In education, in health, but also in water supply, adequate water supply. And so water is in the center of this gap between relief and development, which I think is crucial for the international community to address.
Thank you very much. Can I just follow up that point with you, Antonio, that last point about how we then move on from the relief phase, from a relief mentality, if you like, through to development work? How do you see that link working?
Well, it's not working. I think the problem is that we more or less know how to do humanitarian support. We more or less know how to do development cooperation. What we are not able to do effectively as international community, and of course it's also very difficult for the countries in transition from conflict to be able to do it by themselves because there are poor governance conditions, difficulties in bringing together the conditions for development. And the international community really does not know how to make this linkage. We are too slow in providing the quick wins that are necessary for an emerging democracy, for instance, to be able to prove to their people that peace is a dividend, that democracy is a dividend. And when that does not happen, you have frustration. And, of course, it's the peace process that can be put into question again. And again, in these aspects, education, health, water, basic infrastructure are absolutely essential for people to see that it was worth to achieve peace, that it was worth to achieve democracy.
Yeah. No, thank you very much. I mean, it's fascinating to see water being referred to in that broader political context like that. No, that's great. Thank you very much. I'm just going to move on a little bit onto some slightly more technical type of questions in a way. Trelance, let me put a question to you. The sort of work you're particularly associated with, we could call it micro-utilities or sort of small-scale utilities, decentralized systems. I emphasized in my opening remarks about the importance of designing services that the people themselves want, and I mean it echoes what Antonio has just said. Tell us a little bit about this principle of decentralized services and how that really meets the needs of people.
Right. I think Antonio talked about frustrations, and for an entrepreneur, other people's frustration is the definition of opportunity for the entrepreneur to solve those problems that make the frustrations go away. As we were looking at this problem from our company's point of view, a couple of things were very clear. One is that women and children, primarily that's where the burden falls, have to walk long distances to get water. And they walk long distances to get water that is not necessarily clean. And when we talk about clean water, we're talking about potable water, not just improved water. So you had to solve that problem. It is clear when you look at the economics of big infrastructure projects that they are not viable for low population density areas. So you have to find a way of bringing water to people, and you have to find a way of purifying the water, and you have to find a way of sustaining it. And that's a major challenge. But if you could organize an enterprise that takes on that burden so that somebody who lives in a poor village can have at least close to the convenience that we have in going to your room, turning on the tap, and getting clean water, then you're beginning to do something. So this is not for everybody, but certainly is the idea of if you cannot build large infrastructure projects, you could at least do these village-based or community-based systems that one micro plant can serve up to 5,000, 10,000 people. And if you look at the scale of the problem, and we've talked about the Millennium Development Goals, and you look at how many people need to be provided, in our case, potable water by the year 2015, it's really daunting. When you break it down into little pieces and you say, how do I get there? You get there through these micro-utilities, but you need private capital, you need government help, you need NGOs, you need philanthropists to make it all work. So what we're trying to do is to be the group that organizes all of those things, because it's pretty tough to leave that to a village panchayat in India or some village leadership anywhere.
Yeah, no, thanks. I mean, this is fascinating, and that ties in very much with what we just heard in the plenary a moment ago, Professor Yunus pointing out about that it was a sort of false distinction between rich people being customers and poor people being beneficiaries. And this is exactly what I'm hearing from you, that, you know, people are people, and that we need to tailor the way that we go about serving them according to how they want to be served. So, no, thank you very much.
In fact, they've been telling us that their demands are just as high as those people who live in Santa Monica, California.
Absolutely. No, thank you very much. That's great. Rohini, let me come across to you, and we'll switch across from water to sanitation. Tell us a little bit about how you see some of the evolving, you know, types of sanitation. I'm thinking about ecological sanitation. This is effectively looking at human waste as a resource rather than as a waste product, and that has obviously scientific and practical aspects, but it also has cultural aspects. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, thank you, John. This is really beginning to be a very exciting new space to work in, and people are beginning to call it sustainable sanitation. So it's no longer, while we know the horrific numbers about how many people don't have access, what does it eventually mean? Even if you go about putting a toilet, a soak pit, and a four walls around it, it doesn't solve the entire problem, because the sustainability of the water source, how that human waste goes back into the soil, and it pollutes your groundwater, it pollutes your water sources, and that's not just a third world developing country problem. Even in the best of our most rich communities, we are often putting all of our human waste into the ground and contaminating our ground, or putting it into our water bodies and contaminating them. We need to switch the paradigm to look at our human waste as wealth. It's not waste. We need to look at it as being a solution to the worldwide fertilizer crisis. We need to look at it as helping solve our problems with our coral reefs, our oceans, our rivers, our lakes, our water bodies. And we need the best of minds to put themselves to solutions of creating sustainable sanitation solutions. While it's great to be able to go and flush and forget, at the end of that line, a lot of not nice things are happening that we need to begin to talk about in polite circles. And even though it's a four-letter word that begins with S and ends with a T, you can make it a three-letter word that's called anthropological human waste. Okay, so we can call it anthropological liquid or solid waste, if you prefer it that way. But that is a conversation that needs to come on to, well, if not our dinner tables, at least at our conferences and meetings. So what we are trying to do is to bring a big focus onto that, and we'd like to talk about ecological sanitation, where you have a closed loop on this, and finally, you know, there's not, it's all going back into producing your food, it's going back into making sure it turns into good compost, and we are enabling communities to look at that. And I'll just leave you with a nice, I mean, there's lots of literature on that for you to look at. You just look at ecological sanitation on the World Wide Web and you'll get more than you need. But I'll tell you a nice story. Some of the things that we are doing is, for instance, tying up with the agricultural universities to see how anthropological liquid waste can make crops better and how it can reduce poor farmers' input costs for growing their crops. And one of our research projects includes collecting, ALW samples from a school, because where 200 children are readily there and you have that product which you need, and it's going into the research labs and into the fields. And we have the headmaster of the school and the collector of this, the farmer, are both equipped with cell phones, and they're talking to each other, and when those tanks get full, they're going to be collected. And the last complaint we had, it's working so well that we had a complaint from the farmer saying, why does the school have to close down in the summer? So the ecological, the political, the economic, and the social arguments are all coming together, and we need to continue to develop them. We need better design. We need better investments on that. So sustainable sanitation is the key.
Yeah, thanks very much. I've learned a new term there, too, anthropological solid human waste. You know, there are more than a billion people who literally have not even the most basic sort of latrine, not even a hole in the ground, okay? They shit in public. It's called open defecation. And if they were all doing that in the same place, you would get a pile of anthropological human solid waste, which would fill a football stadium in one day. You know, just think about that. Now, that is a huge problem. You can think of it as a huge waste issue. You can think of it as being revolting. Or, as Rohini says, you can think of it as being a resource. I feel that there are some cultural aspects, you know, in different cultures around the world that we would need to tease out. And that might be something we come back to in a minute. But thanks for taking us forward on that one. Maria, can I just move on to you? We talked earlier about the role of the government, and we've now heard some examples of how other people are fitting together. One of the criticisms of our sector is that traditionally both water and sanitation have been carried out in a very sort of top-down manner. You know, the government is going to do this because they perceive it as a public good, okay, as a service that government does to people. But you and I know that across Africa, roughly 50% of latrines and toilets built by governments for people are not used. So what are we seeing now? Are we now seeing governments that are changing their mentality and moving on from a sort of top-down philosophy to one of really serving people's requirements? Tell us how you see that as a politician looking across all the different countries, either within Africa or around the whole world.
Okay, I think, you know, governments had started off with a top-bottom approach. But what happened that when government had put an asset, maybe toilet facility, water facility and all that, after putting it there, they move on. And that is our saying, that we provide and move on. But what happened that it belongs to nobody, because nobody really made an input in it. So when it breaks down, it's government assets broken down. It's the minister's asset broken down. So we are now, have now changed, because we have made a realization. We are now asking, through decentralization, we are asking the lower levels to identify the needs and then channel them up to the center for funding and facilitation. But the implementation is made at the grassroots level. And that one seems to have an impact in that people own what they put in, on ground. The only problem right now is capacity. They identify the problem, they know what they need, but when you send down the money, the capacity to tender out the work or even to do the work themselves still lacks. So that is now the challenge for governments, to build capacity at the lower levels. And of course we are using, as I said, we are using the NGOs because they are more closer to the community than government can hope to be. So we are actually working. In my government, we have got an NGO, we call it WASANET. That is an NGO, umbrella NGO for all NGOs working in water and sanitation. So these are the groups of people who are down there identifying the problem, helping the community to identify the technology that works for that particular community. And with that, we hope we'll be able to achieve. But on the other hand, this being a sanitation year, we are trying to accelerate it faster. Because we set ourselves a target, by end of December, we must achieve at least a certain percentage. At the beginning of this year, we are at around 50% sanitation covered. But there are areas where we are as low as 3%. So we are now going into a sort of a fast-track activity. We have, and I've experimented it in my constituency, where we are engaging the young and energetic. You go to the college, get them during the school or the holiday term to go and mop house to house to teach the people how to look after their homes, make sure they have got a toilet, make sure hygiene conditions are prevailing, and we have succeeded where we started. So I think now trying to get everybody on board, because it used to be the household owner to provide a toilet for the home. And if they don't provide, the whole village suffers. But now we all move in to make sure that the entire village is covered. And I think that's where we need you people. If there is any money to support a movement that is going to help Africa get sanitation, it's to be able to fund the NGOs that are going to engage the youth to do this type of work, so that we move house to house, make sure that people know what they need and how to do it, and then move on from one house to another. And I believe if we had started in January, by the end of the year we would have done it. But even now, we still have an opportunity. I think we can do it. However, with decentralization again, we have a problem. Because when we send the money from the center down to the lower levels, we have got the small micro sourcing, where everyone does the small sourcing and we don't enjoy the economies of scale. That is something that we have to look at. We have identified it. We are trying to see how to overcome that setback. Otherwise, it seems to be working quite well.
No, thanks very much. And for those of you that don't follow all the details, I have to tell you that Uganda is one of the star examples in Africa of that type of imaginative government leadership, to recognize that the government itself is not going to solve all the problems, but that it's going to set up the policy framework in which other people can. I was also very interested that you noted the point about shortage of resources and human resources at the local level, and that ties back with the session earlier in this global health track, talking about the global health workforce. And I think we've recognized that, haven't we, in water, and particularly in sanitation and hygiene, that we're short of those people with those professional skills to carry out that work. So thanks for pointing that one out. Antonio, can I move on to you and just for a moment set aside your current job at UNHCR? Before that, you know, you've occupied the highest political offices. And thinking from that perspective of a global politician, tell us what we in water and sanitation can do to make our subject more important to politicians at the very highest level of global leadership.
I think that it is very important to recognize that there is not enough awareness about the relevance of water, both as a global resource. We still discuss in today's world oil to be the central global resource from the strategic point of view. In my opinion, water will be the strategic global resource for the 21st century, creating threats to global security and to regional security, but also opportunities for international cooperation. And I don't think there is enough awareness of these, and this is an area of debate that is extremely important. And then also awareness about the role water plays as a community development instrument. In our experience, water is essential not only to supply the basic needs in water itself, but it's an essential tool for health. It's an essential tool for protection. Women that need to go far away to get water are victims of rape more easily than those that, that can find water immediately. And this awareness, again, is not there. For instance, to give you an example, our programs, in order to meet our gaps in water, have not received enough funding, to the extent that we are now mobilizing about $15 million of our own savings due to the internal reform process, shrinking costs in other areas, internal costs, to move money to the areas that do not attract enough funding. And water is an area that doesn't attract enough funding, which demonstrates that there is not enough awareness of the importance of water as a key instrument of development in the political global community and in international organizations. So I do believe we need to join our voices and explain to people how relevant water is, both at the global level and at community development level.
No, thank you very much. Can I just follow up with you on the particular point of the economic benefits? I mentioned when I was just introducing the topic that, the economists who are studying water and sanitation reckon that, a dollar spent on water and sanitation is generating $6 or $8 or $9 worth of economic benefit. Now, that ought to be a powerful argument to a Minister of Finance. But we haven't quite got that through. And those of us that are activists in the sector are not very good at communicating with ministers of finance. Whereas you've been a prime minister, you know how to talk to ministers of finance. Give us some advice. You know, how can we get through to those people?
The problem is that ministers of finance are always much more concerned with CDS, credit default swaps, than with MDGs, Millennium Development Goals.
Yeah, okay, no, that's a fair point. Thanks very much. Let me just remind you folks that we're happy to get your questions coming through as well as we, and you know, feed them into the conversations.
And I'm gonna jump in there really quick. Sorry.
Oh, great.
So, good morning. Yeah, I do have a few, and I didn't warn you, but it occurred to me that we didn't frame this morning and just let you know that the format for this session will be a little bit different. So with the hour instead of the hour and a half, we have collected your questions, and so they're just going to address them directly rather than doing the table discussion. So please feel free, if you do have more questions, we can, if there's time, potentially give another round if you want to enter those in right now. But otherwise, we are providing the questions that have come in so far.
You know, thanks very much. I mean, there's some good ones here. Thanks, everybody. These will keep us going for a couple of hours, if that's okay by you. Trelance, there's a good one here that you'll be interested in, which is about how the community members themselves can make some money out of this. You know, we're talking about the commercial, you know, the power of the commercial sector and entrepreneurs, and you know, you said it all earlier. But what about the actual members of the community, whether they're being involved in water or sanitation? You know, what's in it for them?
Right. I think many of us know that water has been very political in the last 20 years or so, and we have examples of large water companies that have set up in many developing countries only to be kicked out after people found out how much they're going to pay for it. And a lot of the problem emanates from this view that when these companies come in, the water utility that they set up is for them. And they're just making money from quote-unquote poor people, and it raises everybody's hackles. What we've done is to say, look, these are actually community assets. So what we're doing is trying to get governments involved. And what happens is because the problems are usually so big that everybody gets scared away. So what we say is, look, government plays a part, NGOs play a part, philanthropists play a part, and the community plays a part. So we ask a community to provide the land and access to the water source. And we build a system partly from payments from that community and also leveraging private capital, banks, to finance these things. The whole idea is that the asset belongs to the community. We manage the asset, and we show the community that if we can collect small user fees, that community stands to earn a lot of revenue from this asset that they own. And so long as we manage it, you've got something that can be kept up almost perpetually. So they look at how much the community would own. Now, there are obviously politicians whose tenure usually is not the lifespan of anything. So you've got to make sure that there is a good understanding from everybody that this is a revenue-generating asset that is owned by the community. That's the key.
Mm, yeah, thanks very much. Rohini, you wanted to come in on this same point.
Just a quick example is that we've funded and we've also seen other people do this extremely successfully, the self-help groups that women have across the place. They are tools of saving, but often they offer specific water and sanitation related services. So for instance, as a member of a savings group, I can borrow 3,000 rupees to build a toilet. I'm able to pay back the loan in easy installments, and obviously there's a margin for the self-help group itself. And then you create a revolving fund that lets you build the next 10 toilets, and so on and so forth. There's also another pipeline where you're training women as masons to build those toilets, and they're getting paid for the construction of that. So eventually this whole exercise filters it as direct money into the hands of the people.
Yeah, thanks very much. Also, some questions here coming through from our colleagues in the room. There's one for Antonio and Maria. You talked about quick wins, Antonio, and Maria, as a politician. I know politicians always like to see some good success stories. Give us some examples of things where you'd like to see some quick wins. I'm not saying you have to invent them, but what are the areas where you want to see some really good progress? Because here we've got a room full of people that are motivated, they want to get involved, they're CGI members, they want to play their part in it. What are the things that you want these folks to do to get some quick wins and make some real progress?
Well, I think the problem is when we look at the relations between the development community, the international financial organizations, and states, it always starts with big strategic documents, with poverty reduction strategy papers and all those things, and then conditionalities and things of the sort. So when finally the first money translates itself into something that is done on the ground and benefits the people, there is a gap in time. And if you have a restaurant that has an excellent cuisine, but it takes 2 hours for you to start eating, when you get there, you will never go there again, and you feel angry about it. So it is absolutely essential to find ways to help governments deliver in some areas, and in my opinion, water supply is one of them. Of course, education, health also. Some, for instance, microcredit. Is another instrument that can be very important in community development and in job creation. There must be things that you start doing even before poverty reduction strategy papers are approved, strategic development documents are discussed, because if you have to wait for these more global perspectives, when you start doing things, people will probably no longer be there.
Thanks very much. Maria, what about you? Give us some snappy points that you want our colleagues here to get involved in.
I want to support him in one way that for quite some time now, we keep talking, and the process of getting to the community takes much longer than it would have done. So I really would love to see a process that fast-tracks the implementation rather than the negotiation and the paper writing. I mentioned one where we are having to move directly to the community. As I speak now, UNICEF is in one of the most difficult areas in Uganda, that is the northern Uganda, where the war has been ravaging and where sanitation is poorest. We have been able to mobilize with UNICEF and members of parliament and local communities, for we are going to spend 30 days working with the communities to transform the lives of those people, even before we go to debate it in parliament. So we are asking if people can actually say we are going to do in this particular area, moving, do it, and let's produce the results rather than debating what is going to be the likely output or outcome when we do this type of thing. The fear of it, I think, has been too much on the drawing board. We need to be down on the grassroots. Last evening, I was watching TV. I saw a group of people from America who went to Gabon. I think the program is called The Survivors. And they spent most of their time trying to climb a mountain in a village of Gabon. I only wish that group of 30, I think it was 29 or 30, had gone to a village and tried to transform sanitation in that area. We can do a lot more with what is available if we really focus on what we want to do. But I think we are wasting a lot of resources. I think we can do much better.
Yeah, no, thanks very much. Get out there, folks, and get on with the sanitation work. Charlance, do you want to pick up on this? And one of our colleagues here is asking particularly about the large corporations. I mean, your work is at the kind of micro-utility level, but tell us what you think about the large corporations. There are some here, you know, of course, in this room. What can they do at the big infrastructure level? What can they really do to have an impact on this enormous problem of water and sanitation in developing countries?
Well, I have to confess I used to work for a very large corporation. And they have a role to play. And for the immediate term, if you look at listen to what Maria is saying, it's money. And not money as just charity, writing a check and then forgetting about it. But it's money that can be leveraged for action. I think that this issue, and I think we've all heard it, a lot of talk, and people get tired of it. And I think if you listen to all the stakeholders in this water and sanitation area, what everybody will say, we need action. But the action that is needed is on such a scale that it's very difficult for government alone to provide it. And large infrastructure projects, as I said, are very difficult to implement. But what large corporations can do, because they have networks and they have distribution, is actually to provide, and I would say investment, not just charity, and these companies that can go on, focus on solving a problem, and just go out there and do it. And you climb mountains or whatever when you have the free time, but I think the work is about doing it on the ground. It is difficult. In the work, you take somebody who's worked in a large multinational corporation, having to go into a small village, get their boots dirty, get their hands dirty. It's not always that you're going to find a lot of people who want to do that. But we are seeing a lot of interest in this space. We are beginning to attract some very high caliber people who are saying, this is not just something that I do for a couple of years and then go work for an investment bank. This is something that I can do as a living, and it's rewarding living, and it's productive, and the investors can earn a fair return. I think when you do that, you're going to begin to leverage what private capital has, what governments have, what NGOs have, and philanthropists can seed all of that stuff. So that's what we're trying to bring together.
No, that's fascinating, thanks. And I'm just going to come to Rohini to build on that just in a moment. But, I mean, just reflecting on International Year of Sanitation, that whole point that Trelance is making is really one of our key messages in this year, you know, to say that in addition to all the various points on policy dialogue and so forth, one of the critical elements in dealing with this problem of 2.5 billion people without sanitation is actually to get out there and get on with the job. You know, it's very hard work. It's easy to describe the problem. It's difficult to do it. As Trelance says, it involves lots of different sorts of organizations working together. But undoubtedly, we're now at the time where we really need to get out there and get that work done. I think that's a vital message. Rohini, please, build on Trelance's answer there. I mean, the thing about being a philanthropist and, if I may say, a kind of philosopher and a person applying a lot of thought to this sector is you have that intellectual freedom of operation. Reflect for us about this point about the roles of the big corporations, the roles of government. Give us your final perspective on that one.
Right. I'll try to do it. Do this if I go on too long. I'm going to try to make it brief. But seriously, to me, this is an opportunity for me to appeal to all of you in this room. All of us, many of you must be working for corporations. Many of you must be owning your corporations. And I think it's not just the Nestle's and the Pepsi, Nestle and Pepsi and Coca-Cola that needs to worry about water, though they have a huge challenge because at the heart of everything is the license to operate for business in communities where water is scarce, where groundwater is being taken up for corporate use. It's going to be, believe me, friends, it's going to be the next big challenge for business. We have to become extremely sensitive to the way we use water inside the fence as businesses, and we need to be extremely sensitive to how we procure water from the community, whatever relationships we have with governments wherever we operate. As I said, it's not just the big three, it's not just the big five, it's everybody who's in business. Where are you using water in your supply chains? How can you make it more efficient? How do you personally use water? And Pepsi and Coke and Nestle may not like this, but how do you use bottled water? You have to begin to make the connection connections. We used to think water is local, local, local. Increasingly, we are seeing that it's not. Virtual water travels globally, that it travels from dry areas to areas of plenty. It's quite bizarre the way it does. Every single one of us has a role to play, and it's about conservation, it's about our personal values, and it's about understanding water. So everyone has a role to play. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Maria and then Antonio, let me invite you just to give your final reflections as well. We've heard final points from Trelance and Rohini. Maria, what's the final couple of messages you want this audience to take away?
Thank you very much. Of course, a lot has been said. What is it that government expects of us in this meeting? Of course, governments do get money, either through taxation or borrowing from World Bank and whatever. But money or funding that comes from you is really money that should be going down to the community through civil society and NGOs. That's what I look at it. And when you get there, I expect this group to be able to identify themselves or yourself with a cause in a particular location. So that is what I expect, and as the government, that's what we expect you to do. Otherwise, for government, what our biggest setback is being able to build capacity. If you can help government build capacity in the local communities so that they can appreciate and manage the facilities that we put in place, that would be perfect. Another area that we would like to look at is mobilizing, getting people to work. That is one thing that is very well done by civil society, and that's why I'm calling upon you to support the civil society, getting the people to work. As he put it, people don't know what to do. We have talked about it, but they don't know how to go about it. So we'd like you to help us get the people to do the work themselves. It has been said, government cannot do all the work. Things like sanitation is home-based. We need to get the community, the household, to understand what is at stake in as far as sanitation and hygiene is concerned. So we want you to help us on that through the civil society. Government will do its overseeing, over planning, and monitoring. But the rest of the work should be done at the grassroots. Mm.
Thanks very much. Antonio, have the last
just
word.
One message. I think that the relation between water and people is being more and more affected by climate change. And we operate in areas where there is no longer any normal rainfall. There are drought, floods, with all its implications. And I do believe that we need to put adaptation in the very center of all development cooperation policies and to put water in the very center of adaptation policies.
Good. Thank you very much. Just before we close, I would like to point out there have been a lot of other good questions we've had fed through. A number of them have been individual questions to the panelists. So please collar the panelists at the end of the session and ask those questions. I'm going to take the moderator's privilege to answer one of them, because one of the questions says, does the panel think that CGI could do more to encourage heads of state and heads of government to redouble their commitments on water and sanitation? Do we think that Bill Clinton should get on the telephone and talk to these people? The answer is a resounding yes, I can tell you that. Okay, so I'm afraid that we're out of time on the panel. If you'd be kind enough to join me in showing your appreciation for our panelists. Thanks, panelists. In the last few minutes of this session, I'm excited to say that it's commitments time again, and I have the great pleasure of being your compere for announcing, I believe it's three commitments, which is going to be great. And you know the drill by now. You've seen it being done. First of all, I would like to invite up onto the platform, please. Thank you very much. I'd like to invite up Erica Stone, who's the president of the American Himalayan Foundation, Richard Blum, who's the chairman of their board of directors, and Aruna Upreti, who's the director of Rural Health and Education Service Trust. Please, come on the stage. Yes, big hand, please. Are we on these ones?
Yeah.
The commitment is about saving girls through education in rural Nepal, and the American Himalayan Foundation is doubling the size of its current scholarship program in rural Nepal. That's a $2.6 million commitment over 3 years, and that work is being done through the Rural Health and Education Services Trust. This is work they've been doing for 10 years so far. It's obviously going fantastically well because so far they've reached over 5,000 girls, I think, and those are girls in rural Nepal who are now able to stay in school and to be protected from some of those really horrendous evils such as sex trafficking. And through this commitment, the foundation is going to be doubling the impact. You're going to be reaching a total of another 10,000 girls, which is fantastic. And that this will then continue year after year, working with your own staff, with the village coordinators and local volunteers. It's a fantastic commitment, everybody. Please give them a very warm hand. Thank you very much. Congratulations. Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. Thanks for that one. Our second one, still in that same general part of the world, but a little bit further to the west, is in Afghanistan. I'd like to invite Dr. Sakina Yakubi, who's the Executive Director of the Afghan Institute of Learning, onto the stage. Dr. Yakubi, welcome and congratulations. This program is called Healthy Transitions for Afghan Adolescent Females. And the Afghan Institute of Learning, supported by about five different partners, is providing health and education and human rights and leadership training to adolescent females in Afghanistan, and that's enabling those young women to live a healthier life and to advocate for their human rights. You heard earlier in the session that I'm a passionate advocate of water and sanitation, and I have to say in a lifetime's vocation on that work that there is one area that I believe is more important for overall development of our planet than water and sanitation. There's only one, and that is girls' education and girls' development. So congratulations to you. The Afghan Institute of Learning is going to be providing health education to 100,000 adolescent females. It's going to be providing in-depth health workshops to 780 females and their teachers on topics such as violence to women and HIV/AIDS, leadership training, and overall the commitment over 2 years, which is for $585,800. It's a very precise sum. That will benefit 179,302 adolescent females, and it's a fantastic commitment, and please join me in congratulating them. Thank you very much indeed. Congratulations. Thanks a lot. Our third commitment is actually on a global level, and it's quite a different sort of thing altogether. Can I invite up onto the stage Rahul Singhvi, who's the President and Chief Executive Officer of Novavax, Inc., and Joseph Zakruski, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Accelerex, Inc. Welcome. Why do they all have funny names with X and X and X on the end of them?
It's what we do.
Okay. This is a commitment. This is amazing, and it's huge. It's a commitment about affordable vaccine supplies through manufacturing innovation. And these two gentlemen and their companies are doing an extraordinary thing, which is that they're developing avian flu vaccine to deal with the H5N1 flu and a seasonal flu vaccine. And they're using already existing applicable technologies, but in order to manufacture vaccines that are economically sustainable and that those ideas and those technologies can be used all around the world. And this is clearly brilliant. Since 2005, Novavax has already put in $100 million to develop vaccines that are based on virus-like particles. I've never heard of virus-like particles. And in this particular commitment, Novavax is going to be putting in another $150 million to this. And Accelerex is also putting in $50 million towards developing the technology platform, which is already something that's revolutionizing the way these biomolecules are developed. So over 3 years, between these two companies, they're putting in $200 million into this. Now, that deserves a huge round of applause.
congratulations, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot. That's it for our three commitments, and my final duty is another happy one, which is to invite up onto the stage Gary Nell. Gary is the President and Chief Executive of Plaza Sesamo, and that's a non-profit educational organisation which maximises the educational power of media to help children to reach their highest potential. Now, Gary made a commitment last year, 2007, which is the Plaza Sesamo Healthy Habits for Life, and so he's come back today to tell us about his progress on this. So this is Gary's progress report. Gary, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thanks very much. When all else fails, bring the Muppets in. That's what our motto is at Sesame Workshop. We are a nonprofit organization based here in New York, working in over 140 countries. And last year we announced at the CGI that we would work in Colombia to help children begin to improve their own lifestyles by developing a Healthy Habits for Life campaign. Now, Colombia has over a 45% overweight or obese population, believe it or not, and at the same time, about 15% of the population is undernourished. So to deal with this duality, we brought in celebrities and the Muppets and used the power of Plaza Sesamo, which is in over 75 million homes in Latin America, to promote healthy eating, to understand body functions, and to teach children about exercise so that they can indeed become adults and healthy habits for life. The show is now on Discovery Kids since last year, and we have developed teaching materials, we have developed school materials, and now we are doing two things. A teacher training program to use these materials in school so that children, through their favorite characters, can engage in these important lessons. And at the same time, we're working with colleagues at Mount Sinai Medical Center here in New York who will evaluate the progress so we can learn the lessons and improve them later on and apply these through other countries throughout Latin America and throughout the world. Our thanks to the World Heart Federation and especially to the Santo Domingo Foundation for providing funding for this, which came through as a result of the Clinton Global Initiative last year. So that's our progress report, and we want to keep doing more. Thanks.
Gary, thanks a lot. That's an inspirational story. It's an example for all of us folks. Make your commitment, get out there, get the work done, and then come back and report on it. We're coming to the end of my particular part of this, and in a moment I'm just going to hand over to our host and leader, Tom Khalil, and I know that he wants to give some summary remarks relating to the global health session. So, Tom, as I hand over to you, I just want to leave all our audience in the room with that one particular point that came through so powerfully on water, but particularly on sanitation, which is just to say, hurry up, everybody. 2.5 billion people want to use the toilet. Thank you very much.
Well, at the risk of sounding like I'm at the Oscars, I have a lot of people to thank. And I want to start off by, first of all, acknowledging my incredible team. So if I could ask them to please stand and be recognized. They're hiding over there in the corner. Hillary Chen, who's both my right hand and my left hand, probably gotten your fair share of emails from her at 3 a.m. Fiona Walsh, who's just done a super job on the Adolescent Girls panel. Courtney Katz, who took the lead on not only blindness prevention, but on the nutrition issue as well. I don't know where Stephanie Weber, who's been doing a lot of work in the area of the health workforce and how to use information technology and help pull together some really exciting commitments on leadership development. They have just worked tirelessly around the clock to make this happen. So please join me in thanking them for all their hard work. I also want to thank all of the members of my advisory board, everyone who came to serve as a table facilitator, all the people who have not only made commitments, but more importantly, are keeping commitments. And then I just wanted to offer a couple of reflections on the overall CGI process. Obviously, we're proud of what we have been able to accomplish with CGI, but we believe that there is lots of opportunity for improving the process. And my primary request for you is that you really provide us with some brutally honest feedback on what's working for you and what you think can be improved. One of the things that we did this year, for example, is to create the CGI exchange so that there was more of an opportunity for NGOs and for funders to be able to interact. Another thing that we've been doing is not just having individual commitments by a company launching a CSR initiative or collaboration between one philanthropist and a foundation. Those are clearly very important. But where we think we can leverage President Clinton's convening authority is these larger scale collaborative networks that you saw coming together around issues like supporting entrepreneurship by women, the 15 commitments that occurred in water and sanitation that was pulled together by Leah Marshall, a Berkeley 22-year-old undergraduate that Mr. Blum supported through the Blum Center for Developing Economies. So we're really interested in working with the global health community to figure out how to take advantage of this. We want to continue to come up with interesting ideas for panels of issues that are not receiving enough attention or for a new wrinkle on the problem. So even though I now have 450 messages on my BlackBerry, I'd like to give you my email address, which is tkhalil@berkeley.edu, and I encourage you to give some honest feedback on what is working and what you think we could be doing a better job on, and look forward to working with all of you to make CGI even bigger and better for next year. Thank you very much.